Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, and welcome to the Kay Thompson Live Show. It's October 12, 2016, and 8 p.m. on a Wednesday evening on blogtalkradio.com network / Kay Thompson Live with the Kay Thompson Live Show. I am the son, otherwise known as Payne. Maybe to some of you, Citizen Payne. Maybe want to call me something else, but that's a different story. Here's the one and only Kay Thompson.
Oh, all the other things that everybody, that's a few people I call you.
Oh, no. What's your name?
I'm Kay Thompson, and I am your mother. You know, and listen, we have a good show tonight. We are going to be talking to, you know, a friend of mine, a longtime friend, who just lately I have discovered was a member of the Black Panther Party, okay? And looking at a book that was written by Huey P. Newton, who was the head of the Black Panther Party years ago. And they were reactionary, and they were the most, among the most dynamic leaders, you know, resource leaders in the Black community at that time. What had happened was that Jimmy Newton, the founder of this Panther, you know, they were struggling for Black liberation, not only for recognition in America, but around the world. They were annoyed and they were angry. As a matter of fact, Huey Newton was accused of killing a policeman in Oakland, California, spent a lot of years in jail, you know, and he decided along with a group of people that they were going to fight back. And their soldiers, you know, were part of, you know, his organization. And he's quite well known now, you know, and people were in the Black Power movement. So, and Wick Jonesby is going to be calling in too, and we're going to be waiting for Wayne Gilman also. So, is he on the air?
And we're going to be talking about, and that's one of the things we're going to be talking about today. Let's not forget about the news that's been happening all during the week of Donald Trump bus ride with Billy Bush. Locker room talk bus ride that they were just doing with Gayton, and at the second presidential debate, yeah, boy, that was something special. And now, just the way Donald Trump and a lot of Republicans are withdrawing support, not being as supportive of them because of his extreme kind of measures and kind of a willingness just to go after everybody and have no allegiance but to himself. And now he's got to go on a scorched earth, their same policy, just going after everybody, Paul Ryan and I guess John McCain. So the Republican Party is in kind of disarray, but this is the fruit of their labor that they sowed way back. Mitch McConnell and those guys decided that they didn't want to give President Barack Obama any victories, and they would basically sabotage his presidency right from the very beginning. And now they're reaping the fruit. Chickens are coming home to roost, so to speak. So that's what you get when you play around. And, I mean, the crazy thing is that let's first talk about the tape. The tape where they were talking about derogatory, supposedly locker room talk about women. You know, locker room talk, obviously claiming that what guys talk about in the locker room themselves. A lot of times about women. I have a couple of different sides. I look at it from both sides of the story, really. Yeah, he is right. Now, some guys talk in the locker room, or traditionally what it was. Obviously, as society became more advanced and more, more educated, so to speak, we stopped talking. Guys stopped talking like that, you know, became more aware that that's not right. And, you know, with the women's lib and all that kind of movement in our country towards more equality for women, men, I think. During the course of my lifetime, I've noticed, just me speaking here, but men became more cognizant how they spoke about women. And I think a lot of guys maybe perhaps put in more of an effort to kind of look at women with a little bit more respect than was traditionally the way that we get the world, not only the world, our country, but the world, you know, kind of treats women like second-class citizenship. So it's no wonder that men, young boys like myself and young guys throughout our society actually grow up with kind of like certain mentalities. So, you know, here comes Donald Trump one of those mentalities in, within that locker room talk. You want to say something about you? Look
yeah,
like
you know, I don't care what, you know, what, you know, guys talk about in the locker room or among themselves. That's nothing. You know, that's sure. You know, do that. Who cares? It's just that who, you know, has all these strange ideas about women, and then he's talking about them, and he's insulting women, you know. I can't really accept that. And most women, in fact, I don't know too many women who will accept that nonsense. Here he's running for the most important office in the entire world, and he is setting a poor example, you know, for the other men in the world, okay? Donald Trump? He's a joke, you know?
I was talking about him. It looks like we have a caller. Let me see who this might be. Caller, go ahead. You want to say something?
Hello?
Oh, caller?
Hello, this is Jonesy calling.
Ed. We're talking.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes,
yes, it
we
is.
Hear you now. Just, okay, because your number's coming up as all, well, I won't say, because maybe you're trying to be a little bit, you'd like to have a little privacy, but it didn't look like the number we expected for you. But Jonesy, how you doing, first off?
Hi, Eric.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, Eric.
It's nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's better, much, very nice talking to you.
Now, this is like, when I was a kid, this woman on the phone, one of the, and still is, one of the most beautiful women that I ever seen. And talk about young, you know, y'all might have seen Tamara Dobson and Cleopatra Jones and Pam Grier and all that. Shoot. Jones, they didn't have
oh,
nothing.
Oh, my goodness,
Jones.
I used to babysit right on my back. That's so wonderful. Thank you, Eric.
That's who you were. That's who you will always be, the epitome of those types of black women. And as a boy, you know, we're like, wow, Pam Grier, you know, Teresa Graves. And we had Jonesy was the local, was the lady that I had my crush on. So it's great to talk to you. Also want to say hello to Wayne Gilman. Welcome, Wayne.
Hey, good evening, everyone. How's everybody doing?
I'm good, right. Wayne.
That's
Wayne,
good to hear.
Jonesy said hello to Wayne. So, Jonesy, we're talking a little bit about the Trump thing, and I was just talking to my mom about the whole scenario. And so from your perspective, from your political perspective, that we're going to get into a little bit later on in the show, but what do you think about the whole situation that, you know, this election and just all this stuff?
You're asking
what
me?
Do you think about Trump?
No, this is
oh,
for
I mean, I beg your pardon?
This is for Jonesy, Wayne.
Okay, sure.
Well, I don't like to fling out names, but just to be straight and to the point, I think he's an inept idiot.
Thank you.
And how anyone can possibly support him with his lack of politics and lack of agenda surprises me. Well, no, it doesn't, but because and I'm not going to say what I really want to say because I'm trying to be politically correct, but I think it's the route that we're going right now with this whole political scheme, it's an embarrassment. And it's more of an embarrassment to have him even be nominated as a presidential candidate, especially with the vile and foul language that he uses toward women. So I'll kind of leave it at that.
Right. And Wayne, I know where you stand on Trump in general, but in this tape, the situation with the tape I was just talking about with my mom, that, you know, Trump was talking about it being locker room talk and all that. And, you know, there's a certain amount of truth to that. You know, there's a certain amount of truth to it being that's how some guys talk and some guys talk in the locker room. But I was talking about how traditionally in the course of history in the United States that women's rights and, you know, the feminist movement and all that, that men have been forced to take and begin to look at women more like equals. So that means taking on the responsibility of not talking about women in certain derogatory terms, locker room terms, junior high type of terms that you might have. I mean, of course, in the course of life, there are those guys who want to talk about their conquests and things like that, but usually those are the guys that are bragging, and they're bragging more than actually have facts. So what do you think about this particular conversation with your boy Billy Bush there?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I don't really have much to say about Bush's involvement because, you know, at the time, I don't know in what context his role was other than to interview Trump, and it came out. This was obviously not something for the air, And, you know, there have been instances in which people will say things, you know, unintentionally, not thinking that it's going to come back to haunt them. You know, we've seen that with presidential candidates. We've seen that with sitting presidents. I remember there were a couple of instances in which Bush might have said something, you know, that was certainly out of school that should not have been mentioned, but it was he didn't know he had a live mic in front of him, and it happened. Regardless of what was said, it's just the manner in which Trump went after this as saying this is part of his character and profile, that he has it like that because of his fame and fortune. That speaks volumes about who he is as an individual. I mean, if you know that you have that in your past, and you know, I would have to think twice about having to run for an office like that because they scrutinize you left and right. You know, I mean, it's you're in a fishbowl. Expect to be examined. Go ahead. What were you about to say, Eric?
Eric, were you going to say? Go ahead. But I, you know, Billy Bush, and I know the locker room banter. I mean, I don't know, and I really can't say because I haven't been in a lot of locker rooms with a lot of men. Period. But I don't know to what extreme that the conversation takes place. And I'm sure they say a lot of things that are inappropriate toward women. But number one, they're not running for president of the United States, and number two, the way he says that he's a pompous individual, and his apology was read, and he was told that he probably encouraged, for the sake of his position as running as a presidential candidate, that he needs to make some sort of apology. It looked like it was read and scripted, and when he made the apology, he had the audacity to come back with it like a defense, like saying, well, the Clintons did this, and the Clintons. I mean, really, if you're sincere about your apology, you're not going to vent off and go into a comment on Clinton, because to me that was not a sincere apology. He's privileged that he can do something like that by virtue of his position and his so-called financial situation. So whatever it was, and I feel bad for Billy Bush because the radio stations, I mean the TV stations, no longer want him on the air. He's definitely paying the price for
he lost his job.
For, mm-hmm. Conversation.
Yeah, but you know what, Ben? You know, I couldn't care less about what you know. Trump said in a locker room with men. You know, I couldn't
exactly.
care less. You know, I'm not worried about that. But the point is, for him to say it out loud and for him to demean women. How dare he do that? Now he's running for the presidency. Where in the world would he get the idea that he could run for the presidency of the United States? And I was extremely angry. But then, he's a joke. Every time I see him now, he comes up with something new, and it's really becoming very amusing. So, but the point is, it's also very serious because, you know, a lot of people feel the way that Trump does. And the Republicans, they're torn between, you know, a lot of the Republicans don't agree with Trump, but they have to do it for the sake of their party.
Exactly.
You know, they're right in the middle of it.
Well, I mean, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie admitted on radio the other day, he was on someone's talk show and said that he instructed Trump to be very contrite and apologetic about it, but also to hammer in all the points about all their talking points about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's past. And I agree with you. Bill is not running for the White House anymore, and what happens has happened. It's in the past. If you were genuine about your and sincere about your apology, you would not have paraded, you know, people who have accused him of sexual harassment, because, you know, what does that have to do with the contest? You know, I mean, does that make her immoral because she was married to him? You know, I mean, it's sad. And it's like guilt
right.
by association. And I just think it's, you know, it's at a point now, you know, at one point it was so funny, but now it's at a point 27 days before the election where it is sickening. It is despicable. It's shameful to be even calling yourself an American citizen to see the decadence that this election process has turned into. You know?
You know,
anybody
I don't
could...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Wayne, but I just instantly I saw a program on Frontline that was doing a comparison of Hillary Clinton's life as well as Donald Trump's life. And he was told, he had a lawyer, and I can't remember the lawyer's name, but that encouraged him never to apologize, to continue to be tough as he is. I mean, and you can go on Frontline, type in on YouTube or whatever, and type in Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And he was groomed like that from childhood, you know, from his father, because his father was
the
also,
same way, exactly.
So he... So his profile is, but you don't change from who you are overnight. He feels he has success by not being, by blaming others for his faults, not apologizing because he's justified in everything he does. And if you look at his the story in Frontline, that would really explain why his character and who why he is who he is. And now that he feels all this has come out about his comments, it's fair game. So now he's going on the attack. I mean, this is the worst presidential campaign that I've ever seen, and he is at the forefront of the worstness, if there's such a word. He's an idiot.
Yeah,
so what can I say?
Well, that word is developed directly for him now, because he's doing it, and they say that he's pursuing a scorched earth policy where he's going after everybody, Paul Ryan, John McCain, everybody. And it's very kind of Machiavellian, that whole thing, never apologize, you're always right, never admit defeat or admit that you're wrong, because it goes with that whole kind of thing, the means justify the ends. And so you have a rich guy like that who's used to getting his way all of his life anyway, used to everybody kissing his butt, used to telling people what to do. Of course he's going to think that. And, you know, to take it a little bit further, you know, we went to see Birth of a Nation the other day.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about his behavior, similar to the behavior. It reminded me just a little bit of the behavior of the slave master, whose whole was lord of all he surveyed, so to speak. That was his world, and whatever he said went on his plantation. All kind of barbaric and heinous behavior, if he so chose, that slave master, to engage in, was fair game, because he was the ruler and lord of his world. And that mentality, that perspective to me of some Caucasian individuals is what I see in a man like Donald Trump, thinking that he can do whatever he wants, speak however he wants, about whomever he wants, and people are there for his taking, as his outlook towards women. The thing about the hot mic, Wayne, the interesting thing about people, when you're having that and you don't realize your mic, is that you're able to hear an unfiltered who truly the person is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're speaking and you're just talking about that. And, you know, I mean, their side is going to say it's locker room talk. Okay, it's locker room talk. But that revealed who he really is. Even if you thought about grabbing parts, okay, if you're that revealed a certain type of guy that he is, to think that kind of I need to brag and I'm joking around with the fellas and do that. The particular thing is, though, once it becomes from talk to action is when Billy Bush, who's engaging him, gets off the bus and encourages the woman to give him a hug, because then it's kind of like promoting, or let's kind of promote that predatory behavior that Trump was talking about.
Right.
Put this woman unwillingly in a situation. So that's kind of reveals who really this guy is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the talking and stuff, but when you get coming from the subconscious, so to speak, the live mic that they're not aware of the time, that shows you who someone truly is. And this is a guy that thinks the whole world is there for his taking. And now, I mean, even his scorched earth policy now, that everybody's questioning him, he's not used to being questioned, you know, it's kind of like arousing these masses, his base, to support. It's almost kind of like a Hitleristic thing to me, I'm wondering. He's like a, you know, American Hitler. Because it's regardless, anybody that says anything that's in contrast to what he says, he goes after them. Regardless, there's no thought and no empathy to see that they might be right, they might have a point, whatever. And I think,
and you know,
just,
and you know
just,
what, too, Eric, and sorry, hon, and I guess what I, so he doesn't just insult women, and you let me know how you feel about this, but to me, he insulted the institution of marriage, when he made the comment, oh, she's married. So, you know, I mean, really?
Right, exactly.
Here
it is, a married man, married several times over, and he had that to say.
Yeah.
And what did he say about his own daughter? What did he say about his own daughter? What did he say about his own daughter?
Well, yeah. So, you know, there's a whole litany of things that he said. He all but suggested he would even sleep with her if the situation were of such where he could do something like that. He was so he found his daughter so attractive. It was the oldest daughter, if I'm not mistaken, Ivanka, that he was talking about at the time. And I had forgotten that he had had another one by another one of his ex-wives. And I'm just saying, what does that say about your character, you know? I mean, there's so many things that this man has said during the course of his presidential campaign. If they were supposed to be, if they were all segued together and played back, you know, as a spot to put on the air, you know, it would just show a lot about who he is. You know, you could start off with his campaign against the Latino judge that he had a problem with, his gesticulations about a reporter who was deformed. I mean, we could go on and on about different things that he's done in the last year and a half.
What about the
just trying to become president? And with respect to Billy Bush, I think his role is minuscule in all this. I think this is all part of, first of all, Billy Bush, he's part of the entitled. He's the nephew of George H.W. Bush. And the thing is, I am certain this was part of the game plan, you know, that they cooked up. They knew that this wild sound was in the background somewhere. And they figured that you do this to my son, well, I'm going to have the last laugh, because they all turned around and said that they're voting for Hillary anyway. There's no secret that the Bushes and the Clintons are friends. And the thing is that, yeah, they're staunch Republicans, but they also have a certain amount of common sense, and they can see buffoonery and stupidity when they see it, and that's what Donald Trump is all about, you know? I mean, it's just sad. I mean, Billy Bush will find another job. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Pop's got big stock at NBC, because it seems like half the younger family's working there. And, you know, the deal is, it is what it is. But it's just unfortunate.
Really,
and speaking about all, you know, not to get off about the issue of business, but I was telling Kay yesterday off mic about this interview about the president of Home Depot, who I give a lot of money to because of what I do with my my homes. And I just wish there was greater competition. This 87-year-old ignoramus that runs that store with his wig looking just like Donald's comes on Fox TV and extolling the virtues of a man that you would think was the second coming of Christ, the way he talked about Trump. And I was, like, really taken back by that. You know, I mean, it's like he just the 87 years old. And if you don't know what's going on in America with respect to the degradation, the racism, the sexism, and all the other things that go on here, then don't even bring yourself before a national audience to discuss what you knew that went on 1,000 years ago when you were in your prime. You know? You're lucky enough to even erect the Home Depot.
Well, those people support him. I mean, I'm not surprised that, you know, there are certain individuals that support Donald Trump. I mean, like Rudy is his boy, too. So that's not surprising. And Billy Bush is really just a non-entity. He's the convention that gets us to the story. But
yeah.
The thing that we notice, and, you know, part of Donald Trump's appeal is that they say he tells it like it is, because there's inherent in government and in politics, all citizens on whatever side, whatever perspective you're coming from, we know that people take advantage of the system. There are individuals within this greater whole of the system that have taken advantage. And the populace has seen that over the years, that government and certain politicians can take advantage. But you know who else can take advantage? Rich people.
Yeah.
And when Donald Trump tells these people, I'm going to show you how, because I know how the system works, because I used to take advantage of the system. But, you know, yeah, you used to take advantage of the system that's crooked, that you're calling crooked and you know the ins and outs and everybody relates to you because of that. But, you know, also, too, you didn't have to take advantage of the system. You didn't
exactly.
have to take advantage of those loopholes that you could have. You could have chosen to pay more taxes than you had to. You could have chosen to use your foundation for other things as opposed to using other people's money that give to the foundation, and then you could act like that's your donation. So just as much as these people want to talk about political correctness and freedom of speech, it goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that they can see it becoming an issue is when it comes back to check them and keep them in line. You know, freedom of speech is you also have the freedom not to insult people, not to say derogatory things about people, to build people up as opposed to tear people down. So, you know, their arguments, you know, political correctness, let's stop being political correct. So then we're going to call America a white racist society. That many of the larger population, whether they were actively a part of receiving advantages through that system or not, but just by their sheer whiteness, gained advantages. That might be politically incorrect to discuss, but that's a fact. So it's just like Hillary calling half of his people deplorable. Well, it's not 50%, it's 46%. And half of you people that might think that it's okay to be racist or that people, are because they're a different color or a different race or a different religion, are substandard, yes, that exhibits a certain amount of ignorance in you, a certain amount of unintelligence for one to think that way. It might be politically incorrect to say that to you, but it's a fact. So we don't mean to hurt your feelings with the facts. So they got to understand that when you say something, you got to really live by it. And the whole thing about Donald Trump is he wants to have it both ways. That's why he's using the base to get them all riled up, and because half of them are ignorant and they want to revolt if the election doesn't go their way, they just don't. They're not even trying to learn anything.
And talking about and talking about the possibility of a revolt leads me to our next topic. And I hate to leave this one, but it's because it's really, you know, like fitting in a little bit. You know, we're talking about fighting back, okay? And, you know, for us to be talking about this kind of person to lead in the most important country in the world, that's absolutely impossible. So we do have to have organizations and groups that fight back. And our guest today, Jonesy, we can't, you know, say her real name because she was in the military for, you know, a number of years, but she was also a former member of the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party, the head of that and the founder of that was Huey P. Newton. Now, Jonesy, how is it that you were a member of the Black Panther Party and I didn't know it all these years?
You
it
know,
was a secret?
It's something that when you have parents like I have, it's something you just don't advertise on a constant basis. Well, my parents were very strict, and, you know, and at the time, the FBI was really hot and heavy on the Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
So we just never discussed it. You know, but it, I don't know. I thought I talked to you about that.
No. That was the first time. You know,
because I really got heavily involved with the Panther Party when I went to college, but I started out a little bit selling newspapers in downtown Newark. And my uncle, by the way, there's no history of that. Huey and Bobby Seale were students at Oakland City College, and they ran, and then they talked to my uncle, who at the time asked him to be the advisor for the African American student organization, and they were also Bobby Seale and Huey Newton and my uncle were very responsible, they were able to actually get the first African American studies program at Oakland City College. So and then my uncle would talk to me about the Panther Party because Bobby Seale and Huey Newton used to actually come to his house for dinner. He told me years ago before he passed that Huey Newton told him once the party became strong, because it branched off, and that's when the Black Panther Party started to evolve in Oakland. I became a member because I didn't like what was going on at the time, and I was a radical. I wanted to see change. So basically, talking to him and knowing what the Panther Party was standing for, it was because a lot of Black people were being killed even at that time by police.
Sure. And that
so
was
the
reason for the You know,
go ahead.
In his book, Revolutionary Suicide, that was a leader because of the fact that so many black people, you know, in the black community, you know, were being killed. Being killed by police, by police persons, okay? Coming back to Trump, Trump is a racist, okay?
Right.
And I think probably if he got in, there's going to be a whole lot of that going on. So maybe the Panther Party, you know, they do something, and Huey Newton, you know, was in jail for a period of time. However, he was a revolutionary. So how did you happen to be in the party and stay in the party without a lot of people knowing? It was secret?
Well, no. It was never a secret subject. When you're a Panther, you know, unless you are actually in the forefront of one of the leaders, they don't really look at you. But what happened is and this was also in Newark, but they actually had a lot of people that became members of the party, and it's not so much as being, you know, not, you know, I didn't have a really significant role in the party. I was just one of the individual member to help with feeding the children because, you know, they had the free breakfast for children program that they actually started in Oakland. So I decided I went to a meeting. And I actually decided at the time that this is something that I feel could make a change and do something good for black people as a whole. And it was so sad because the Black Panther Party got such a negative rap because J. Edgar Hoover decided that the Black Panther Party was probably a very, very – it was a danger to the internal – organization to the United States as a whole, you know, because they were against the war in Vietnam, they were against a lot of things that the FBI, anytime you get an organization that becomes very powerful like the Black Panther Party, because they started in 1966 and they went across to Newark, New Jersey, well, you know that, in Boston, they were all over the United States. And so when you got a black organization that powerful, it's like, wow, we got to do something to control this. And a lot of leaders, like you had Geronimo Pratt, a lot of the leaders were very, 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 very strong leaders, and they were supposedly against what the government was doing. And they were sending people to Vietnam to die left and right, black people in particular, and they were killing other people of color.
Mm-hmm.
In that, people, minorities.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So I decided to become a member, like you were saying, Kay, because I wanted to see change. In the 1970s, I mean, I was 1970, I was out of high school, went on to Rutgers University, and that's when I was there with a lot of radical individuals, Nikki Giovanni, Nathan Hurd, Sonia Sanchez, and to me, it was important that I got involved in what was necessary to help my people as a whole. And I just, at the time, I thought the Black Panther Party was doing something very significant to help our people. And if you have to pick up arms and defend yourself, so be it. But don't do it unless it's necessary, because that's a Fifth Amendment right. Is that not, to be able to carry weapons?
Mm-hmm.
I never carried.
Well, I tell you, as you mentioned all this, Jonesy, I mean, this is really hitting home because I guess you and I are about the same chronological age. I remember distinctly all those things that were going on, and the Panthers regrettably got a bad rap because there was a lot that they were doing to empower the black community without having. I mean, they would not take sit down for any kind of foolishness. They would challenge, you know, anyone that would go against what would be considered the norm. But at the same time, you know, these people were very proactive in terms of empowering the community, helping one another. And I think there was a lot of confusion between the Panthers and, of course, the Black Liberation Army and other splinter groups, Young Lords and organizations like that. And, of course, given J. Edgar Hoover's background and what he has done and over the years, there's no question that that he would have obviously taken an interest in wanting to destroy and disseminate all the activities of what you know, blacks were doing at the time to empower themselves, and that's it. His history just speaks to that. But I remember distinctly some of the things that were going on. You mentioned Nikki Giovanni and Angela Davis appearing at college campuses and speaking out about some of the things that were going on with the war. And you're right, there was a preponderance of people of color fighting in Vietnam. I remember one day going to it was like my last year in high school, and friends of mine that the high school I had gone to, we agreed to go to Coney Island one day and celebrate. And one person who I was very friendly with, unfortunately, his draft number was very high in terms of the list, and he was called to go to Vietnam the next day. You know, he told me, I always remember this, and he didn't really survive. But on one of his tours back home, you know, we were sitting in my mother's house, and he was telling me how he was on the Ferris wheel that afternoon at Coney Island on a Sunday, and he was fighting the Kong the next day on the front lines of Vietnam. Less than 48 hours. I mean, that was enough for me to try to stay out of the war as much as possible.
Yeah, and the Panther Party was very adamant about not going to war, not serving. And because it was such, and it's what's so distressing is that any strong black organization that appears to be a threat to this country is automatic. It seems to just crumble. All of our black leaders gone.
Yeah.
Assassinated, killed. J. Edgar Hoover started the counterintelligence program in order to infiltrate and to destroy the Panther Party. And unfortunately, they were very successful because they had
COINTELPRO.
They had black individuals that infiltrated the Panther Party, and they caused a decision, not just division on the West Coast and the East Coast, and we ended up being at each other, not being at each other's throat. Then the division came, and when the best way to destroy an organization, and this is what they did during slavery, is to divide and conquer.
Yeah.
They took the parents.
Well, I'm still trying to understand the phenomenon of the House expletive, but there are so many of us who, you know, who are in the House, you know, beating up on each other. And, I mean, that's the biggest problem that we face, especially, you know, Ben Carson from the Republican Party talking about Trump. I don't know if not to get back on that, but, you know.
Well, yeah,
Let me say one more thing about the party, because I joined it again because it wasn't just because it was a ragged organization, not just because I didn't like what was going on at that time in the 70s and the 60s, but also because they did a lot of really good programs. They had outreach programs for that sponsored sickle cell anemia tests. They did free food and things for the people that were poor, and especially the free breakfast program. We used to feed children. And that started also in Oakland at St. Augustine's Church. So the Panther Party wasn't just a radical organization against the establishment. They had 10 plan points, 10 points that they lived by, and they changed a couple of them once they decided to become more of a political organization. But it, as a whole, at that time, I was strongly into what we need to do to improve our society as a black society as a whole. And I felt at the time the Panther Party was the only organization that was really doing. I mean, Martin Luther King was doing a lot, but and he did it the right way. I mean, he wasn't violent. It was strictly nonviolent. But when you're seeing people get hosed and beaten and bitten up by dogs, I mean, he was a great man, Martin Luther King was. But at the time, at my age, I just wanted to be a little bit more radical.
Right.
Okay.
That's why, and I think that's where Malcolm X comes in and appeals to a lot of young African-Americans that weren't even in the Nation of Islam and the rise of the Nation of Islam. And they also suffered the infiltration of traitors. And Malcolm X, of course, you know, I worked in the movie, so that whole kind of vibe was dealt with a little bit, that there were interlopers in the organization. And it's really kind of, I guess it's what they call serendipity, that Jonesy was a member of the Panther Party, and all these years later, not only did I get a chance to meet Bobby Seale as he appeared, because he appeared in Malcolm X in one of the scenes with, along with Reverend Al. But also, a buddy of mine was my former film company producing partner was writing a film about Geronimo Pratt.
Exactly.
It was about the time when they got him out of jail, a film that was supposed to be produced by Sean Penn at the time and Marlon Brando. And another former associate, Eric LaSalle, was involved in producing this. And my buddy Dave Johnson was involved in trying to develop this script about Geronimo Pratt, which ended up being, his take ended up being something else that they wanted, because whenever you tell one of our stories, you've got to have a significant amount of white people in it to be able to tell our story. And thus why we had thus why we had Marlon Brando and Sean Penn that were supposed to be involved in the film. It never got done. But through my friend's association, he would tell me about being with Pratt and getting to know him really well and going down to Louisiana, you know, after Geronimo Pratt left California, went back to Louisiana. And I met him a couple of times when I was in California, the great Geronimo Pratt, who was defended by Johnny Cochran. Pratt was sent out to California after he had done time in the service from the elders down south, from what I understand. So how everything comes back to a big circle that you used to babysit me. You had this association with these great individuals.
Yeah.
I was able to meet them. And really, this film, Foot Soldier, I wish it could be made. I don't know if my partner's still trying to make it. But, you know, and it's also the, you know, I wanted to say, Shakespeare said, what's past is prologue, right? So you guys got involved at that point in time. A lot of the young people were inspired to get involved, but it'd be a little bit more radical because of the killings. The obvious press was covering a lot of the murders of black people, which have been going on since we've been in this country. So now, all these years later, my generation, we got to kind of get lulled to sleep, the 80s and everything. But now, all these years later, with technology being what it is and having them walking around with a camera in your hand, now people are able to capture this police brutality against people of color once again at the drop of the hat. Not only capture it, like Rodney King was captured on tape, but then to instantaneously disseminate it to the world.
Exactly.
So now we come to a point in history that the young people once again are kind of rising up, similar to the way that you guys did in the 70s, shortly after the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King getting assassinated along with Bobby Kennedy and the people. So the Black Lives Matter movement comes up now in 2015, 2016. History repeats itself. So we need to be a little bit more like the Panthers in having that comprehensive program, because, you know, when you feed somebody, when you put somebody, you clothe somebody, and you feed somebody, that's when they see, people will tell you, that develops loyalty.
Yep.
But also you have a loyalty to your people. That's why when you see some of those old Eyes on the Prize films and the Panthers are sitting there and telling the young, you hear them, overhear them saying, come on in, young brothers and sisters, y'all can eat. And that's still a problem to this day, that children go to school without having a proper breakfast in the morning.
Exactly.
And we have those programs, a lot of programs at the government office, but still, it's your community that should offer. And so
exactly,
what the Panthers created that threat that you're talking about, Jonesy, because not only did they do that for their community, but many of the points young progressive whites were agreeing with the Black Panthers about.
Exactly.
So
yep,
they were influencing. Can you imagine if one of them was a rapper at the time?
Oh, man, are
you know,
kidding?
Because if we fast forward now, that's how we're getting that message out, right? I mean, because,
right,
you know, the whole rap, since, I mean, that's how we're getting the message out. And before we had gangster rap and all that, that took it a little bit off. You know, they say gangster rap started with N.W.A.
Yeah.
But if you listen to N.W.A., they were talking about some real revolutionary stuff. You know, it took a different turn with other individuals talking about their drug deals and becoming rich and all that. But people say the gangster rap really started with N.W.A., but N.W.A. had a song called F the Police.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were influenced by a certain amount of a political awareness more than some of the people like to give credit for a gangster rap. And so we come to this point again where this madman, right, and it reminds me of like around Reconstruction when slaves were free, started getting elected to offices, things like that, and the white people lost their mind and the Ku Klux Klan became big in America and blacks had to kind of go underground a little bit. But now again, we're here at this point in history when they feel unempowered again, right? Because we elected a black president. And then there's a woman that's getting ready to come up who has a lot of black friends. and they're getting ready to cheer and bring her black friends and continue this black president's agenda. So they're all rising up, and they want to say something's wrong. It's not going away. And so that's why they start crying, like, they're stealing the election. They're all kind of they're trying to precondition the public now, right? Because some of them are saying, Trump doesn't win, the election was rigged. You know,
he's already working on that. Yeah.
Yeah, and in the second debate, the two moderators were against him too. So it was 3-1. So everybody, this guy got a problem with everybody that don't agree with him. All of a sudden, everybody's against you, huh, money? And it couldn't be the fact that he's an ass.
Eric? He becomes the victim when it becomes necessary. Okay. Yeah, and
exactly.
And the young, and I think the young youth, because everything you're saying, I mean, it hits so strong with me. If we can get our young people, the younger population in this country to get together, to say no more, we're tired. I mean, the young people, the ones, and perhaps they're the ones that really got Obama elected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
We have a caller in. Caller, let's welcome this caller. Caller, who are you? Or you don't have to say who you are if you don't want to, but if you want to join the discussion, you can talk now. I got your mic open. Hello, caller.
Brothers and sisters. This is Dr. Jeffries.
Hey, Dr. Jeffries.
I had just indicated I would try to get in at 8 o'clock before you all got into your heavy discussion, but I got caught up in New York traffic. So, but yeah, continue. I'm following.
Dr. Len Jeffries, everybody.
Yes.
Evening, Dr. Jeffries.
Yes, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to hear everybody making the connections. And, you know, I'm one of these long-distance runners. I've been, in a few months, it'll be 80 years. So I've been
on
the East Coast and all the various struggles around the world. So I appreciate you all putting your connection together and your analysis, because we need it. We need it. As Malcolm said, the discipline that's best, that will reward us best, is history. So we need to know the history. So, and not just his story. We need to know the history. And then we can make our moves and make our analysis and keep the struggle going. So I'm listening. So go ahead. Y'all continue.
Stay
That's beautiful.
Dr. Jeffries, stay with us.
Well, Woody, I wanted to ask you even more, if you wanted to make a comment about what we're talking about, Dr. Jeffries, in terms of the Trump scenario or just the historic repetition that we see a little bit that I was just talking about. The past.
Well, my approach for us to understand where we are, what has happened to us down the road, and what will be happening to us, is we've got to have a systems analysis. And when we focus in on an individual like Trump, we get what I call a paralysis of analysis. We're focusing on that individual, but we need to see the system that produced him and how he's impacted on the system and what that system means for us. So we really will be caught in a constant relationship of what this individual did, and this one grabbed somebody by the genitals, and this one looked at another person. But it's the system that has demeaned people of color, that has put the Native Americans through a process of genocide that is still a reality. And we have to, as we deal with the system, we've got to devise our understanding of it so we can find out what we need to do to move it out of the way or to change it or to make an accommodation to it. So systems analysis is key. And when you're talking about systems analysis, you got to link up three important things. Economics is the first principle of the universe. And economics has to do with your creative, productive capability. And so when we're talking about what the Panthers understood and what they tried to do and moving things, they dealt with that economic question. But you needed to go deep into what that economics meant and all its ramifications. But economic standing alone is not going to do it. The breakfasts were good, and taking care of the youth and showing the community that we need to do a communal thing is meaningful. But then the economics needs to be linked to politics. Politics is that management capability, that administrative capability. So economics and politics have to be seen as a continuum and a relationship to each other. But the key of these three elements, economics, politics, is culture. Culture tells you what for economics to be about. and to analyze the existing economics and the economic processes that were missed. And culture tells you who to do your politics with. And so you have to understand that the system produces folks that are going to do you in, folks that ain't right, folks that have been miseducated, folks that have been misdirected. And so culture tells you to look deep at the person that you're going to be relating to and you're going to be working with. So those three things, economics, politics, and culture, we have to link together, and we have to agree, no matter what our perspective is, that it's got to be a revolutionary process. It's got to be change. It can't be more of the same. Trump is more of the same. Hillary is more of the same, because there's only one system, and that's the system that they're all playing with, and that's the system that we're in, thinking we're doing something while we're in the system. We elected a black president, but that's what he was, a black president. He did not and was not the system. The system used him. And so we have to understand that they always go to black when they're in trouble. That's Camille, a beautiful sister, said to me, because she was in the theater. And she said, when white folks are in trouble in the theater, you go to black. And so the system was in trouble. So they went to the good-lookingest black man they could find, had a beautiful black wife and two beautiful children. So, but the system was still the same. The system is still functioning. So I understand the Panthers played an enormous role in the revolutionary fervor of the 60s into the 70s, but the system, what kind of system are we going to project, and what kind of system do we want economically, politically, and culturally? So that's the dialogue, that's the interaction that we need, and we need to thank our sister Queen Mother Kay Thompson for allowing us to come together and hit these airways and try to deal with some serious questions instead of entertainment and whatever little interactions that we might have that don't meaningfully move us into systems understanding. So,
well, I hope we're going to be I hope we're going to be continuing with you next week on Wednesday.
Well, certainly.
Okay?
And I are tied together in struggle in ways that it would be embarrassing to say. So anytime I can enhance what you're doing, anytime you can enhance what I'm trying to do, We are family. We're family.
Well, you've been doing yours a long time there in Harlem and New York and every place else. So listen, you know, stay with us right now, because when I finish, you know, talking about, you know, the fact of the Black Panthers and the different organizations that came out of it. And is there a way to stop Trump there?
Let me just talk about, Dr. Jeffers, you talk about a system, right? And that you're exactly right. As from my vantage point, which has been increased a little bit now about politics and how government works. And I say that because of the passing of the generation and the new generation being in a position to get a little closer and more upfront to watch the inner workings of government. It's very important, you know, it reminds me of an analogy when they talk about government spending and government is making government's the problem, government is too big, and you got so many people working within the government. When you go to the Capitol in D.C. and you walk through the Capitol, and you see a lot of the people that work there, that do the everyday jobs, that work at the little mail room, the post office that they have down there, and they work in the cafeteria that they have down there, and some of them are police, Capitol Hill police that are down there. You know who's in there a lot? A lot of those jobs are black people. And
not only that,
you're
right, brother. When I went to Washington for a big event trying to get some aid for Africa, and we were upset because the economic thing was controlled by Indians, even in the Ghana embassy and even in the American, in the Reagan building when we went up to deal with that. But I looked at all these government buildings and the people who were there with weaponry were our people, men and women, in every single government building. And so we were there to protect. They go to black. You want to have some protection, go to black. You want to build plantations, go to black. Brother, you hit it on the head. You hit it on the head.
And you know what you said, Jeffries, and I'm glad you said that, because I think had the Panther Party been, and they were strong at one point, and they did a lot, but had they touched upon and really dealt with the economics, politics, and culture the way you're speaking about it, perhaps we would not have been it would not have been able to infiltrate the organization, because they would have had a better understanding in how to deal with the system as a whole.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, the system, I think the best thing about someone like a Barack Obama, right, he put certain judges up for nomination to get it on a superior court here or a court there. But hopefully what we're able to do is get within that system, within the infrastructure, because that's how, those are the cogs on the wheel that turn the, you know, when they say turn the wheels of justice, and you have that black judge there that can give a little bit more context than that white judge, provided he's not like a Clarence Thomas type. But, you know, there's someone, there's some of us, if we get a lot of those with within the various levels of the infrastructure within the system, and that's when we change the system, when people understand that. You know, it's like Trump had an issue with this Mexican, with this judge who happened to be Mexican that was ruling negatively against Trump in the case. Well, guess what happens then when the next young Mexican law clerk that's coming up that's going to get appointed for the judge? He's going to remember his responsibility and to understand that in this country, you're always going to have to be aware of that kind of racism that's hard to die within the fabric, within the system. Because as you know, Dr. Mm-hmm. Jefferson, this country was built on white supremacy and the enslavement of black people, right? That was their business at one time.
That's ideology. That's the culture of white supremacy. This country was not built on freedom, justice, and equality. I'm tired of hearing people talking about it. Even as I speak, they're on TV talking about the nation was founded on freedom. It was founded on injustice. It was founded on genocide, and it put it in its documents and in the whole narrative. So we need to have some clarity in looking at this thing. You know, every one of the founding fathers were slave masters. I like to clarify who they were. They were slave master. My wife said, don't use slave master. Slave owners. Slave owner bastards that established this nation. Every single one of them, including Benjamin Franklin.
That's right. That's right.
And just a couple of days, we're supposed to be celebrating Christopher Columbus. Black folks should declare, y'all celebrate him. Native Americans and the millions that were destroyed and Africans that were put in the dehumanizing process, we can't celebrate this man. He didn't discover anything. The man was lost.
Exactly.
He was lost, and he was a criminal. That's why he started
right.
calling the Native Americans Indians, because he thought he was trying to go to India, if I'm not correct.
One of his voyages, he came back in chains because of his own criminality. But let's not deal with the paralysis of analysis. They were producing predator conquistadors and predator adventurers. And so that whole concept that he represents was rampant in their culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about
slavery
now.
I don't want to hear nothing about Jefferson. In fact, my favorite founding father is T.J. Thomas. I don't want to hear about Washington. I want to hear about George, whether he told a lie or not, cut down a cherry tree. I don't give a damn. But the person I like, because he represents the best of America, white America, is T.J. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of Negroes. I mean, the pursuit of happiness. Four plantations.
Right.
He
engaged in the miscegenation process with a few.
You better believe
quite a few.
Yeah, exactly.
You're saying Thomas Jefferson.
There's a whole history about him.
Patrick,
I have some neighbors that are related to him.
Well, everybody,
we're coming up on a minute to the end of the show, so we're going to have to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Dr. Jefferson, we've got to do another hour because I want to go get into the world history of how we start talking about, you know, how a lot of those sphinx and those structures over in Egypt, those noses got blown off and what, you know, the they thought when they were there. But we got to go. Thank you, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, for calling in tonight. That was a great surprise, and happy to hear you talking to us. Thanks for calling.
My pleasure.
Linda Jones. Okay.
Thank you.
Jonesy? All right, Jonesy.
Linda Jones is fine. You can conclude. That doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's all good.
All right,
I'm retired.
That's right. And they better not mess with you because that's my baby to the right there.
But, baby.
Love you. Love you, Jones.
Love you more.
Bye-bye. And Wayne Gilman. Sir, what do you think?
Always a pleasure. Sounded so personal. I didn't want to interrupt.
All right, there he is, the legendary newsman, Wayne Gilman. Thanks, Wayne. Talk to you next.
Thank you.
My name is Eric Payne, the son. You are a lady.
Wednesday, 8:09, 4:00.
the Kay Thompson Live Show on Blog Talk Radio Network. And also, we want to tell you it's archived, so you can listen to the show every week, anytime you want, because it's archived, and we're on every Wednesday. Good night. Thank you.